Welcome to Ordain and Establish, a podcast of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition at Catholic University. To learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.
Okay, so we've got questions 56 to 60. So now we are really in central territory for St. Thomas on the Boethius. He's done all the lead-up work. In the Prima Secundae, he starts off with a treatise on happiness or man's final end. Then on the actions, you know, what's the difference between a good or a bad action? And he specifies there that for an action to be good, it has to be good in three respects. That is, the object of the act has to be good. The natural kind or type or sort of action has to be of a generically or naturally good kind. So something like almsgiving or moderation in food and drink have a good object of the act, whereas something like murder or adultery doesn't. So you have to have a good object of the act, but it also has to be done with the right intention. So if I give alms for the sake of vainglory, it's not actually a good act for me, even though the act of alms in itself is good. And then thirdly, it has to be in the correct circumstances, propitious or appropriate circumstances. So if I give all my money away and that means I can't feed my children, then even though it's a good act with good intentions, the circumstances are poor and therefore it vitiates the act as a whole. So you get the basic sequence of good in the object, good in the intention, good in the circumstances equals a good act. If any of those are missing, it equals a bad act, at least for me here and now. And then he has a treatise on the passions, which some of the material we're looking at today heavily draws upon, where he gives what Philippa Foote, student of Elizabeth Anscombe, called the most impressive philosophical treatment of the emotions in the whole literature. You know, it's something that gets a lot of respect even from non-theologians. And then finally, what we looked at yesterday, the treatise on the habits, which is laying the groundwork for today's material, which is on the virtues per se. And then Father Catchton will talk about particular virtues, later on the cardinal virtues, the theological virtues, and then the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which are seven habits, but are not quite virtues. They're more specifically given by God in a way that they're less principles of operation and more of inspiration. But he'll talk about that as well as the Beatitudes from Christ's Sermon on the Mount. So really getting into the sort of central territory of Aquinas' virtue theory. But in this session, we've got first in 56, the subject of virtue. Subject, of course, refers to that which possesses the virtue. And so the points of discussion there are, if you think of our humanity as a natural form, and you parcel that into different powers or capacities for action, for engaging with the world, you know, even sort of man on the street language would recognize the difference between things like thinking, feeling, choosing, and so forth. But Aquinas has a very elaborate moral psychology is the technical term for it, where you've got, you know, very broadly, you've got reason and the will on the one hand, then you've got the sensitive soul and appetites on the other, and then what he calls the nutritive or vegetative soul, the part of you that just does things like grow fingernails and digest foods, but isn't capable of virtue because it really isn't permeated by our choice and intentions in the same way. And then our material powers like locomotion and so forth. So what he's interested in is how far does virtue go in terms of these? You know, some of these are low-hanging fruit. Obviously, virtue is relevant to the will and the intellect, but some of them were gray areas in his time and, in fact, for hundreds of years. So you have questions about whether his term is the irascible and concupiscible powers are the subject of virtue, which is another way of saying, are appetites and passions capable of being configured and ordered virtuously? And there was a centuries-long debate about, in effect, the role of the emotions in the moral life. Are they a kind of dead weight
Are they something adversarial? That reason just has to beat down and the will has to resist the temptations of, sort of like the sirens and Homer's Odyssey? Or are they in fact something that can be brought alongside, can be in effect part of the team and rectified along virtuous lines? So much of 56 is about that, because you're not going to get a virtue in something like the eye or the dejection. So some of those he goes through quickly, but others are more complex. And then 57, you've got the intellectual virtues, where you especially have the spade work laid for the virtue of prudence. In 58, you have the difference between what he calls the moral and intellectual virtues, which is really interesting because most people think, you know, if a virtue is a moral, what is it? You know, it sounds like all virtues are moral, but Aquinas actually distinguishes between intellectual and moral virtues, and we'll see how. And so forth. The relation to the passions and how the moral virtues differ from one another. So that's kind of the conspectus. But a few points in addition to the issue about the passions are really important here. I think one is the idea of the intellectual virtues, things like science, understanding, art, and prudence, being negotiable in terms of whether they're full-blown virtues or virtues simpliciter, or whether they're sort of virtues with an asterisk beside them. So that's another area of dispute. Aristotle regarded them as full-blown virtues. Aquinas regards some of them as virtues in a more restricted sense. We'll see why. But the gist is that something is only going to be a virtue in an unrestricted sense if it's either under the control or jurisdiction of the will, or at least is oriented by the will. And that's very interesting, because one of the implications of that is something that an ancient Greek, you know, say in Pericles, Athens, might blame a man for being. For example, let's just say you're really stupid or foolish, you know, just completely by nature. You see this, yeah, at Homer, where Odysseus berates this one character and everybody just laughs at him. But something that nowadays we would say, oh, it's not his fault. You know, he has a certain condition, or you could say it's something pathological. So the whole spectrum of things like we now diagnose as non-culpable, like mental illnesses, would be another good example. Aquinas has space for that, because something's not going to be blameworthy or praiseworthy unless it's under the will. So it's a kind of interesting carve out that things that you are good qua human or bad qua human for actually relate very intimately to the will. So in other words, if you didn't have control in terms of this condition or process coming about, then it doesn't make you a bad person to have that. So it's an interesting point. Then, tremendously important, this is in 58, is the idea of, he asks the question whether you can have moral without intellectual virtue and intellectual without moral virtue. And it quickly gets to, there's a kind of laser-like precision on one point, which is, can you have prudence without justice, temperance, and fortitude? And can you have justice, temperance, and fortitude without prudence? So it's a really focused question. And you see they're almost like the different strands of a spider web or four walls in a room. They're so intimately related that his conclusion is that you can't have one without the others. And therefore, the virtues are not just mutually reinforcing. It's not just that having the virtue of temperance helps you to have justice. So, for example, if, you know, I'm totally dominated by my passions, my appetites, and my desires for something like food or alcohol, then that's going to severely compromise my ability to exercise the virtue of justice, right? I might spend my paycheck on things that aren't actually good for my family if, you know, I'm just actually enslaved to lower desires. But his point is more than that. It's that you can't actually have the one without the other. And therefore, this is what we call the unity thesis of the virtues. But we'll see how he gets there. It's a very robust claim, Some people find it counterintuitive because the tendency to speak of, you know, I have some virtues and some vices, you know, I have my good points and my bad points. But actually for Aquinas, as for Aristotle, and really the whole tradition, Augustine, Ambrose, Cicero, Seneca, and so forth, if you have any virtues, you have all of them. And if you have any virtues, you have zero vices, which seems to be a really high bar. So we'll see how he gets there and what the implications are for that. But it, all of that material we were discussing about yesterday, habituation and the causing of the virtues, you know, that's partly why there's such focus there, is because they really see virtue as almost like the moral equivalent of becoming an Olympic athlete. You know, it really is viewed as something extremely difficult in the natural order, although because of the infused or gratuitous or supernatural virtues, the idea is that because of God's grace, you can actually receive these virtues at the spiritual level, the grace level, the supernatural level, even if you don't necessarily have them at the natural level. So that'll be more this afternoon, but it makes for interesting questions like, can you have something like supernatural or infused prudence, but not natural or fired prudence? So you could, you know, if you think of something in the sort of devotional literature tradition, something like the holy fool. So somebody you wouldn't trust to run a budget or, you know, maybe, you know, even just be able to make regular decisions. They may be very bad at running their life, not be very good at execution, follow through, deliberation generally. But they will, it's faced between, you know, their loyalty to Christ and something less. They'll always know the right decision to make. So that's, you know, you can have something like infused prudence even without acquiring prudence. And a lot of people like this because it seems to make the requirements for virtue, you know, to use language some would use, less elitist. So you don't necessarily have to have been brought up in this absolutely marmoreal, idealized way like Plato and Aristotle expected, where you have sort of perfect education, upbringing, you know, you're well-bred, you have this kind of training and habituation, not only in moral matters, but intellectual matters in the arts. But the idea is, well, not everybody gets that, so what about everybody else? So the idea that even a Christian who hasn't had those possibilities, but has received Christ's grace, and therefore has the supernatural or infused virtues, a lot of people like this as leveling the playing field, as making the virtues more available due to precisely God's gratuity. Two other big points in these readings. One is in 58, Article 3, where he talks about the difference between virtue and continence. So I'd like to look at that briefly, because he views, in common with Aristotle, human beings as occupying four moral stages or levels. The idea is that, you know, every single human being either is vicious or what he calls incontinent. The Greek word is enkrateia, it's incontinentia in Latin, or continent, that is self-controlled. The Latin term is continentia, that's where we get continent. Very different from the English sense of that word, like you would see at a pharmacy. And then fourth is virtuous, which is what you're aiming for. But it's interesting that there's a kind of sense of a whole spectrum and of the possibility of movement within that spectrum, possibly from vicious all the way up to virtuous. But we'll look at those four stages, because Aquinas, more so than Aristotle, believes that there can be a kind of vertical movement, either upwards or downwards there. And then finally, this comes up in one of the questions, the idea of the virtuous man acting with enjoyment or with promptness and pleasure, and precisely why that is and what it means and how it reinforces the idea that happiness as such is the virtuous way of life, because not only are you doing good things, but you're doing them for the right reasons. And you're actually enjoying it. It's not as though you're doing it resentfully or as it were under protest, like someone paying their taxes. The idea is that the virtuous person actually has not just their will disposed in the right direction, but even their very tastes and enjoyments correspond to the mean or measure of virtue. So the first point then, this is in 56 on the subject of virtue or the possessor of virtue. I have a slide on this, but again, the idea is if you can almost imagine, just by a very rough analogy, that the soul is being like a house with different rooms. So he views the soul as one. And this, interestingly, was contested in St. Thomas's own time. Some people thought you had three souls: vegetative, sensitive, and rational soul. But Aquinas views the soul as one for a variety of reasons. So you have kind of unified agency. Some parts of your soul are not that morally interesting. You know, things like nutrition, digestion, the fact that your hair and nails grow, your skin sheds, and so forth. Where it becomes more morally salient is at the level of the sensitive and the rational. And so what he's doing in these articles, talking about the subject of virtue, he's basically saying which virtues, particularly the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, and then the cardinal virtues, fortitude, temperance, justice, and prudence, where do you fail those? Because the idea is that they don't just permeate your moral agency or psychology like gas filling a room. The idea is that they're actually perfections of specific powers or capacities. And those capacities are precisely the parts of the soul. So the rational part of the soul, subdivided into the cognitive, reasoned self, which has two aspects or forms of directedness: the speculative side of the intellect, which concerns that which is the case of the true; the practical side of the intellect, which concerns that it should be the case or the good. And then corresponding to this on the appetitive side is the will itself, the part of us which seeks and desires the good in accord with our human nature, but at the rational level. So whereas the sensitive appetite is attracted to what St. Thomas calls sense particulars, like you're hungry, you enter into a room, and you smell pizza. And what it actually does is the perception of the smell of pizza actually kindles an appetite towards that pizza. So you reach out for it, you desire it, and so forth. So the objects of the sensitive appetites are sense particulars, you know, things we see, touch, taste, smell, and so forth. Whereas the will regards not sense particulars, but universals. So you desire something at the level of the will because it's fun or interesting or praiseworthy or holy or something like that. All right, so he's concerned in this question of where you place the virtues. That's what he means by the subject of the virtues. So one claim he makes in terms of the intellectual virtues, I mentioned this, is that the subject of a habit is called virtue simply only as it is in the will or some power insofar it is moved by the will. So if you look at something like that, if somebody has a physical deformity, you wouldn't call it a vice, because that's not something that is subject to the will or is directed by the will. If somebody had some sort of disability, same thing. All right. Having said this, and this was, maybe it's a bit of a no-brainer for us. You're all lawyers. So you probably think a lot in terms of culpability and non-culpability, things like this. But it was really important in this time because for Aristotle, that wasn't actually the case. So an intellectual disability, you could have called a vice, because a vice, in effect, just meant a human defect. The idea was that
whether it's your fault or not, you know, whether you chose this or not, it just makes you a defective human being. Just like, you know, if a horse is laying, you know, as a broken leg, it may not be its fault, but it's still a defective horse. Whereas Aquinas makes it far more related to what's actually under our own control or will. All right, but where he really takes off in this question, because there was no debate over whether the will and the intellect could be possessors of virtues, you've got justice in the will, you've got prudence in the reason. The real sort of battlefield was, what do you do with the sensitive part of the soul? You've got these appetites. So the appetites themselves are related to sensation, you know, taste, touch, smell, and so forth. But the idea is that when your sensation operates, your appetites then engage with your sensation as a kind of needy inclination of your own humanity to pursue certain goods. So that's precisely why, you know, if you smell food, you have an appetite to eat it, and so forth with the other inclinations. So this could be either something good, like the smell of food that creates an appetite or desire to eat it, or it could be something bad, like you see a large spider on your pillow and you feel a kind of fear or hatred of it. And so St. Thomas, if you see the concupiscible and the irascible, again, the interest here is, where do you park fortitude and temperance? This is what he's ultimately getting at. He says, the passions are distinguished not just by good and evil simpliciter, but by whether the good that attracts or the evil that repels us involves some difficulty in either getting or avoiding it. So he says, passions of attraction or aversion simply are called concupiscible. Again, this kind of a jaw cruncher in English, but it comes from con, which in Latin means with, together, or strongly, and cupio, which means to desire. So the sense of concupiscence is to desire something strongly. Those that involve difficulty are called irascible, from ira or anger, because that's one of the emotions associated with it. So he says in the Treatise on the Passions, whatever passions regard good or evil simply belong to the concupiscible appetite. For example, joy, sorrow, love, hatred, and the like. Whereas those passions which regard good or bad as arduous, that is, the good I want is hard to get, or the evil I want to avoid is difficult to avoid, that difficulty actually generates a different set of emotions, which are analogous but relevantly distinct. And they belong to the irascible appetite, such as, he says, daring, fear, hope, and the like. So hope is different from desire. Fear is different from hatred, and so forth, precisely for that reason. So the concupiscible passions, armed motions of the concupiscible appetite, and the irascible passions of the irascible appetite. So that's, you know, a really quick flyby of the various powers he's talking about here. And the big debate is, if you think of that whole middle territory, it was contested by moral philosophers and indeed theologians in terms of whether it could become virtuous or whether, like things like locomotion and nutrition, digestion and growth, it was an amoral or immoral or just indifferent part of our humanity. So it's a really interesting debate, right? What do we do with our emotions, desires, and appetites? And it had been going on for centuries in St. Thomas' time.
So who's on the other side here? Is it the Franciscans primarily?
Yeah, so the you've got two major players on the... So the long story short is that St. Thomas is going to say the sensitive part of the soul can be a subject of virtue. So your desires, appetites, and emotions can be configured and made virtuous. On the other side, though, you have, again, a centuries-long running debate with the Stoics, on the one hand, with very complicated moral philosophy and psychology, but really quick points, because Aquinas engages with these throughout the articles. They make sophisticated arguments based on the idea of happiness not being something that falls within the goods of fortune, as they call it. And the basic intuition is that in life, there are those things you can control and those things you can't control. You know, it's the sort of Stoic starting point. The things you can't control, precisely because they're outside your power, could never be made the source of happiness because they're completely subject to luck, chance, and misfortune. So the idea is that anything that's related to these emotions, like hope, fear, sorrow, and so forth, these emotions are themselves prompted by the goods of fortune, which are variable and evanescent. It's sort of like chasing a mirage in the desert. So the kind of Stoic philosophical therapy is to gradually disengage yourself from those objects. They don't reject all emotion. They have what they call eupatheia, good emotion, which is a sort of dispassionate and stern sense of joy, like we might call the joy of a good conscience through doing the right thing. But in general, they pretty much sideline the emotions. You know, there's no room for hope, for fear, for sorrow. You, in effect, have to expunge all of that from your humanity, because those emotions are like heat-sinking missiles targeted towards goods of fortune, which aren't your proper source of happiness anyway. So things like falling in love, you know, they would see as almost like a kind of drunkenness that just causes you to be delirious, to see things astray. And so it's a little bit like Buddhism. You're trying to achieve this kind of tranquility of mind that they call apatheia, which is where we get the word apathy, where you in effect euthanize that side of your emotional life. And so there was a huge debate over this. Are the emotions basically, first of all, directed towards things that won't make you happy? And so they're sort of misleading. They're sort of like, you know, if you think of a detective story where there's a false clue at the beginning of a story, are the emotions sort of like false clues leading you on the wrong path through things like hope and desire and so forth? That's one of their claims. And they have very sophisticated arguments for this. So Aquinas takes them seriously enough to attempt refutation, just like St. Augustine had beforehand, by saying that the emotions aren't irreclaimable or somehow outside the moral sphere. First of all, they can't be evil, and there's sort of scriptural reasons for saying this, like the fact that Jesus wept or he showed anger. So they're very invested in the idea that emotions can't per se be morally compromised. There has to be some sense in which some display of emotion can be morally, an instance of moral rectitude. But the other, you mentioned, Robert, the Franciscans. So a little bit after St. Thomas's time, you'll have a formidable figure who is actually a blessed in the church, John Duns Scotus. In fact, if you go to the Franciscan monastery tour today, you'll see him in a stained glass window with an image of the Blessed Virgin Mary and the Latin inscription that says, "Allow me to praise thee, Holy Virgin. From this verse, give me strength against your enemies," because he was known as the doctor or promoter of the Immaculate Conception. But one of his claims was that you do not have virtues in the sensitive appetites. So whereas Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas said that you, in fact, do, that fortitude or courage rectifies or perfects the irascible appetite. All these emotions to do with things like fear, danger, and daring. And temperance rectifies or perfects the concupiscible appetite. All of those things having to do with physical desires and then emotions like liking, attraction, sorrow, and so forth. Scotus argued that actually even fortitude and temperance, like justice, are in the will. So what that means is that the appetites themselves are not actually made virtuous. They're in effect almost like somebody who has a guardian because they're not able to run their own life. The emotions or appetites are just placed under the control of the will because the sensitive appetites will always in effect be misdirected or have a kind of congenital tendency to blunder off in various directions because they're just pursuing, you know, whatever tastes good or whatever feels good, things like that. So yeah, there were opposite players here. And then later on, Immanuel Kant and others will take up a view rather similar to that. But for Aquinas, if you note the Stoic view and Scotus' view, they really sideline the emotions in the moral life, which would leave a major part of our humanity outside the scope of virtues. Aquinas doesn't view it this way, but there have been a few options. One is to view the emotions as indifferent to morality, a little bit like Immanuel Kant's example of what's called the sympathetic shopkeeper. So this is the guy who, you know, maybe he gives you a good deal because he's has a positive or sanguine disposition. He's feeling good, and so he's kind to people. And Kant says that has no moral credit because he's just doing it out of a kind of inclination or temperamental disposition. The only way he could add moral credit if he did his duty only because it's his duty. That's the only good without qualification is a good will, which is a will which intends its duty precisely because it is its duty. In that case, things like the emotions are rather indifferent to the moral life. You know, it might be nice if you're feeling good, but it gives you no credit or demerit in terms of your moral choices. Another view of the emotions, you see this in a lot of the sort of 17th, 18th, 19th century English novels and moral literature, you know, some of it Anglican, is the idea of the emotions as adversarial, as something that it tends to have a misleading or tempting effect, and that reason, in effect, has to control or beat down the emotions. And the relationship between reason and the emotions is a little bit like that between a cat and a dog. They're perpetually seen as in a kind of conflict. Interestingly, St. Thomas believes, with Aristotle, that the passions and appetites themselves can be permeated by the virtues. So in effect, if you think of morality as a lifelong project where you're trying to be a good person, there's a sense in which you can get your sensitive appetites and emotions to be on the right team, at least characteristically. It will never be a sort of 100% success rate for reasons we'll discuss, because the emotions are less susceptible to the command of reason than the will is. They're a little bit more tied up in sense particulars and the animal side of our nature, but there is a level of training and coordination they can have that actually may permeate them with virtue. Does that make sense? So that's the kind of key stakes.
So he says they're subject to political command.
Exactly.
Which is an interesting metaphor.
Yes. That's right. There's, let me find that passage.
That's at page 71. It's question 56, article 4.
Okay, let's pull it. So 56, article 4, if we start from the said contra, it's actually a good passion to read it, passage to read. Says, on the contrary, fortitude is assigned to the irascible power and temperance to concupiscible power. Whence the philosopher, that's Aristotle, of course, says that these virtues belong to the irrational part of the soul. I answer that the irascible and concupiscible, say that 10 times really quick, powers can be considered in two ways. First, in themselves, insofar as they are parts of the sensitive appetite. And in this way, they are not competent to be the subject, that is, possessor of virtue. Secondly, they can be considered as participating in the reason from the fact that they have a natural aptitude to obey reason. So the idea is that the passions aren't rational, but they are responsive to reasons. And thus the irascible or concupiscible power can be the subject of human virtue. For insofar as it participates in the reason, it is the principle of a human act. And to these powers, we must needs assign virtues. Otherwise, of course, sensitive appetites would lack the proper kind of moral stability and directedness that he and Aristotle have in mind. And he uses this interesting analogy that reason uses the sensitive appetites and the emotions like a craftsman using his instrument. So you think of something like an electrician or a plumber or a carpenter. They come to your house to do some repairs. You know, they absolutely need the right tools, you know, the ones they have tailor fitted for this specific project. And Aquinas has the same idea in view. You know, if the carpenter shows up and he doesn't have the saw, the hammer, the nails, but he just has something like we might have, a bunch of books, he's not going to be able to do the job. And Aquinas thinks similarly, if the will is trying to operate well in virtuous actions and conduct, but the emotions are all refractory, then you're sort of like a craftsman without his tools. So he says, therefore, the virtue which is in the irascible and concupiscible powers is nothing else but a certain habitual conformity of these powers to reason. So somehow the passions and appetites are integrated in virtue. Like you said, Thomas, he talks about, he often says that reason has monarchical rather than despotic power over the passions. So this is a very Aristotelian idea that the monarch rules his citizens, but precisely as citizens, not as slaves. And so there's a sense in which he's expected to rule them well, you know, if he's not to be a tyrant, but it's a good regime. Here you're viewing the soul as almost like a miniature city-state, like in Plato's Republic. Reason rules the appetites and the emotions well, monarchically, but in effect, the monarchical rule presupposes that the passions have an ability to, in effect, answer back or make their needs or desires known. Unlike, say, something like a slave, which just has, you know, in Aristotle's view, no right to representation. We don't rule our emotions despotically, whereas we do with, say, our body parts. So Aristotle will say, I rule my body parts despotically. You know, I can just command my arm to go up or down. You know, I can just command my legs to walk, and they do so. They have no, in effect, interests in declining my rule.
So I can see clearly where this disagreement about whether or not the temperance of fortitude are in the sense of what I see clearly how it works out as cracked real differences about matters and practice between Aquinas and the Stoics. Where does it come out empirically or in practice between Aquinas and Scotus? Is it in how trainable your sensitive appetites would be? Because presumably Aquinas and Scotus are going to free down the line on what's right and what's wrong in any particular case. So where does it come out in practice? And what difference does it make? Whether I say the subject of those virtues is the sensitive appetite or the will.
Say somebody has the virtue of temperance and a sub-virtue of temperance is the virtue of chastity. So it's not that St. Thomas thinks that the person with their sensitive appetites made virtuous in this way, that the sensitive appetites themselves can choose for you or deliberate for you. But they have been actually habituated to like the right things and dislike the wrong things. So actually your likes and dislikes on St. Thomas's, but not Scotus's view,
have been trained and habituated. A little bit like if you think of a dog that you've trained to do certain things. And so therefore, it's not that my passions are going to do the deliberating, but for example, on Scotus's view, chastity might be something like, I will to do the chaste thing even though I don't want to. Whereas for St. Thomas, you characteristically, if you have the virtue of chastity, want to do the chaste thing, and you actually feel dislike for the unchaste thing. So for example, maybe on Scotus's view, someone who's married wants to be faithful to their spouse, hears a joke about adultery, and his co-workers all laugh about it. And he, on Scotus's view, he recognizes that it's wrong and suppresses the desire to laugh. On St. Thomas's view, actually, he wants to be chaste and faithful to his wife. And so even at the level of affect, he's been rendered virtuous. And so Aquinas would assume that the chaste man who hears a joke about adultery actually feels disgust at the joke. Do you see what I mean? Feels a sense of dislike and disapprobation. So the feelings themselves have actually been trained. And again, it's not a 100% success rate. People can be tempted. People can feel the wrong thing. Just like a dog that's been trained well can sometimes, you know, do what it shouldn't do and its master has to yell at it and call it back. But it's much better than a completely untrained animal.
Well, in your point earlier, it's a two-way street. So Aristotle and Thomas also believe that there's desiderative deliberation. The desires help you in your deliberation. For Duns Scotus, that would not be, that'd be absurd.
Exactly.
But trained desires help you. Your trained passions help you in identifying the good and going after it.
That's right. In 59.5, he says, virtue overcomes inordinate passion, but it produces ordinate passion. And that ordinate, that is good, rightly ordered passions, help to execute reason's commands.
Yeah.
So the person who feels disgust about an adulterous joke, that's actually reinforcing his reason's recognition of that is wrong. Yeah.
It also seems that on Tave 71, that Robert rightly pointed out, that it's an anthropological Kant. That Thomas is resisting that the sensitive powers in man are like they are in dumb animals, but that they participate in reason. And to the extent that the sensitive powers participate and obey reason, they must qualify as a subject for virtue. Mm-hmm. And it plays out in the ways that you were describing, that the virtues can be trained to act in accord with right reason in themselves as part of a more comprehensive anthropology of a human person.
Exactly.
I wonder how far this goes, though, because while it makes a lot of sense to me that under Aquinas' account of what virtue is, you would need the passions to be able to be trained in this way, because if they were constantly at war with reason, you would not produce a stable disposition. You would instead produce a disposition that was always unstable, always at war with itself, right? And so if you were defining virtue as this kind of stable, consistent disposition, it would need to be the case that the passions could somehow become at least consistent with, if not, you know, directed in the same way as reason. All that, I think, makes good sense. But one implication of it that I wonder about is, hey, when we think about the sacrament of confession, people confess things all the time. Priest friends tell me, do the priest people confess things all the time that are just off sins? Right? They'll just say, like, I got angry or I got sad about X, right? And my priest friends will say, well, that's not itself a sin. In fact, that you felt that emotion is not itself a sin. It matters of what you did in response to that. But I actually wonder on Aquinas' account whether you can make such a categorical statement. Because while the passions are not, as you said, going to always be pointed in the right direction, even in the virtuous person, insofar as you achieve virtue, they should be reliably off, you know, most of the time, pointed in the right direction, which would mean that somebody who consistently has their passions going in the one direction, couldn't you say under Aquinas and Town, is culpable for that emotion, because they have failed to train their passions to accord with reason. So they're in a sense permitting themselves to experience a passion that is wayward, and that is pointing them in the wrong direction. Why couldn't you say under the Aquinas and Town that you can actually commit a sin through experiencing an emotion, experiencing a passion?
Yeah.
Because you have failed to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it reminds me of something Baron von Hugel said. He says, I kiss my son not only because I love him, but in order that I may love him. So one interesting implication of Aquinas' view is you actually have a duty to try to habituate yourself in good emotion.
Right.
So it's sort of like, if I don't feel love for my mother-in-law, I actually should go about trying to cultivate a better relationship. And how do I do that? I can't control my emotions the way I can control my arm or leg, but because the passions are responsive to reasons,
right?
Deliberative reflection, you know, on you think of the book of Proverbs and the way it praises the good wife. And in biblical literature, they talk about this as a similar sort of thing. The idea that a husband should not just take his wife for granted, but actually reflect upon her good qualities. So this is an example of that. Now, you can't control your emotions, but you can encourage and persuade is probably the best way to describe the relationship between reason and the emotions. That you can persuade them a little bit like you can't control a toddler. You know, you can command a toddler, but sometimes they just freeze up. You ever had that experience where you're near a street with a young child and you tell them to stop and... You know, so an emotion can't be commanded, but it can be persuaded. And we do have a duty to do that. And you can see that in all kinds of things. So I see a huge spider and I feel fear or loathing. But then I reason to myself, the spider isn't that big and it can't actually kill me. And so it doesn't just remove the emotion of fear, but you can actually see how the emotion of fear responds to the reasoning by being reduced.
Right.
And similarly, where... yeah, let's say you had culpable deficiency in good emotions, like just one of my kids I didn't like, or I had a harder time liking and I showed prejudicial partiality amongst my children. It would be something where I had the duty to try to encourage the right emotions. And if I failed to do that, that could definitely be culpable. Does that?
Does that mean, though, that... So what I'm pressing on is the extent to which this complicates a very common, and I think a straightforward understanding of what is culpable in when it comes to this act of confession. And under Aquinas' view, given exactly what you just said, which I agree with, that seems to follow from what Aquinas is saying, does that mean that you can actually commit sin because if you experience furry, wayward passion, and you have not acted to correct that labored passion and habituated it to the, you know, to channel in the right way, then even the experience of the passion is culpable, morally culpable, because you...
if you entertain them.
That's the distinction that's exactly the distinction actually I'm challenging, is that that's the distinction that's always drawn in confession, that you have to actually entertain the emotion, you actually have to act on it in some way. But if the mere experience of the passion reflects a deficiency in the duty to have it habituated in the first place, is that morally culpable as that is?
Yeah, this comes up in the literature over the case of the conscientious racist, it's called. Rosalind Hirsch talks about this in her book on virtue ethics, where she says, suppose you have somebody who, you know, really just detest somebody of a certain other race, but they're always good to those people. You know, whenever they meet them, they go through all the motions of saying the right things. You know, they would never be unjust or discourteous to them, but they just can't stand them. And she says, is there something morally problematic about this? Of course there is. Is it culpable? And I think for St. Thomas Aquinas, if you have, let's say, that hatred, And the causes for why that hatred came about are under your own voluntariness. You know, if you were reflective enough to understand what is going on, then you would have antecedent culpability. Just like if I got drunk voluntarily and then drove and entered into a collision, I would be blamed for that collision. Even though when I was driving, I was drunk and not fully in my full state of rational deliberation. But I would be at fault for the vice. In this case, it would be a my vice of hatred. Let's assume there were voluntary causation in that. But in a given instance, let's say this person who has that see somebody of that race and just feels an automatic emotion of hatred towards them. Would that be culpable? I think only if they acquiesced in it. So they might have a vice of hatred for which they were culpable, but in the moment when they actually felt a sort of dislike or distaste or disgust or whatever, they might actually think, no, that's wrong. I shouldn't do this. This guy, he's really a good guy or something like that. But if they acquiesced in it, then I think it would be the act of a vice and therefore culpable. Does that make sense?
There's no sin without the will.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But Joel is raising a different and I think very interesting and difficult point. And that is that given that the emotions participate in reason, and as Thomas says, who have in some respects a will of their own, that we are obliged to penetrate the emotions with right reason. And if we don't do so, the impact will be that this emotion will be cut free of reason and bring us to an unwelcome spot or a bad spot. And even in the moment, you're protesting that you don't have to entertain it. But the fact that you're brought to the bad spot reflects the antecedent negligence.
Right. The near occasion. So.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't take a position. Yeah,
I think I would say that sometimes it reflects antecedent negligence and sometimes it reflects other things. Bad training as a child. You know, some type of, you know, more unhealthy brain state that's caused by something outside your will. I mean, I don't think he could simply say that everyone under all circumstances, regardless of his physical condition and regardless of his prior history, could train all of his emotions to be correct.
That's fair, Robert. But I just want to, and I don't want to divert us too much from David finishing his remarks, but I just want to point out that one need not go to that extreme to deny the other extreme, which is what I was pushing it back against, which is the idea that that experiencing a passion is not itself ever culpable.
Correct.
Right? Like that, I'm saying that isn't it possible that on our finds kind of actually taking something in between?
The sin isn't experiencing that passion. The sin is a different omission that you made in the past.
A sin of not controlling it.
That would be the sin of that person in confession. Not that they felt the passion the time they confess it, but that over a long period of time before then, they hadn't done enough to work on that.
Right, that's right. No, that, and that's an important distinction, but it nonetheless shows that the passion itself is indicative of something morally culpable. Yes. As opposed to, unlike the very simple response when somebody says that they, when they confess something about some emotion, of saying, well, that's not a sin. It's like, okay, but that's not actually fully addressing what could be happening here, right? Mm. Under Aquinas' account, I would think.
Yeah. But it is true. I mean, a sheer passion isn't morally culpable. Well, there has to be consent. But yeah, very good point about how this precisely ties in the habituation. If you have a vice, then it's going to disorder your passions characteristically. So due to antecedent causes, you'll constantly be having bad passions for reasons that were originally your fault.
Right.
Yeah. Good. So important to habituate the sensitive appetites. Aquinas thinks you do that for things like temperance through moderate eating and drinking at the level of acquired or natural temperance, and through things like fasting and asceticism at the level of infused temperance. He's actually quite taken with that idea. He calls it spiritual training, exercitium spirituale, the idea of fasting. His list includes vigils, meditation, manual labor as a kind of remedy for concupiscence or the wounds of original sin, reading scripture, avoiding the occasion of sin, and so forth. But the kind of dark side, unfortunately, of the theological account is the reality of original sin. So whereas Aquinas builds in a kind of positive factor that Aristotle lacks, namely grace, Christian theology also diagnoses a congenital flaw that Aristotle didn't have, which was original sin. And what original sin is essentially is the privation of original justice that was given to humanity in the integral or unfallen state. And the privation of that original justice has created four wounds. These are discussed by the Venerable Bede, and Aquinas endorses them. But basically, there's a kind of ignorance in the intellect, a weakening of the will in its pursuit of the good, and a sort of inflammation or disordering of the appetites. So even though they can be rectified and harmonized and permeated by virtue, at the same time, it's almost like a body that's generally healthy, but in that body, there is a cancer which has gone into a kind of remission, but there's still cancer cells floating around somewhere in that body that can wreak havoc. Similarly, because of concupiscence or the fomes peccati, the foams of sin, there are inordinate motions that will afflict the appetites and the passions. And interestingly, in the Western theological tradition with St. Jerome, St. Augustine, and so forth, somewhat distinct from the Eastern theological tradition with the Desert Fathers, John Cassian, Evagrius, and so forth, the Westerners tended to think you can never fully defeat it, that original sin will be something that you battle with till your dying day, whereas some of the Eastern Fathers were a little more amenable to the idea that you could achieve tranquillitas animi. You could just have a kind of Buddha-like serenity in overcoming once and for all the effects of sin. But Augustine and others said, you can never quite get there. So even if you add the virtues of fortitude and temperance, you're still liable or vulnerable to temptations to sin. So this is their way of saying, you know, it's very good to be virtuous, but you can't let your guard down.
Is there, could you just say a few sentences about the different perspectives of Calvinism and many forms of Protestantism and Catholicism about the impact of original sin? That is, are the accounts ontologically different so that a Calvinist would say that the power of the will and the intellect is intrinsically disordered by original sin, whereas Thomas might say it is wounded but not intrinsically disordered? And is that on the territory, off the reservation?
Yeah, the exact Calvinist position I know is contested. The sort of in the air account you often get is that Calvin affirms total depravity, which means that the natural powers are subject to a sort of complete privation. So even what fallen man thinks about God before he receives the grace of the gospel is a sort of just tendency to blunder. Whereas Aquinas thinks that the natural powers are wounded, but still remain essentially good.
That's a point.
And so we lose none of our natural inclinations to the good in essence. And again, this is a sort of secondhand version of Calvin, so it's subject to correction. A more in-house version of this was Jansenism, which said that, the way one author put it is that the Jansenists thought that at original sin, a new species not created by God sinned itself into existence. And so the idea was that the will and the intellect and other powers were so infected by original sin, that they didn't pursue the good at all. It's almost like human beings became, you know, like something from science fiction or fantasy, some sort of monster species. And so grace actually becomes a kind of violence to reform you dramatically. Whereas for Aquinas, you know, he always affirms the phrase gratia non tollit naturam sed perficit. Grace does not remove nature but perfects it. So he still views grace as essentially good even though wounded. Sort of like, you know, an injured leg is still good. It just happens to be injured somehow. So what that means, this has all kinds of implications, though, for things like the possibilities of natural law, knowing the good at an elementary level, pursuing the good, and so forth. Okay, if we could highlight question 58, article 4, on how the moral virtues require prudence, and how prudence requires the moral virtues. This is a really important aspect of his whole virtue theory, similar to what you would find in Ambrose, Augustine, and Aristotle. So in 58:4, he says, moral virtue cannot exist without prudence because it's a habit of choosing, i.e. making us choose well. Now, in order that a choice be good, two things are required. First, that the intention be directed to a due end, and this is done by moral virtue, which inclines the appetitive faculty to the good, which is in accord with reason as a due end. So if you've got, if you've got justice in the will, and you've got temperance and fortitude in the sensitive appetites, and at the theological level, you've got charity and hope in the will, then you've got moral virtue comprehensively, and it means you're pursuing a good or a due end. But he says, secondly, that man take rightly those things which have reference to the end. This he cannot do unless his reason counsel, judge, and command correctly, which is the function of prudence. Therefore, there can be no moral virtue without prudence. So very strong claim. One way to put it is, in any given situation, it's not self-evident what the just thing to do would be, what the brave thing to do, what the honest thing to do, what the generous thing to do, the charitable thing to do would be. Well, how do you determine what the virtuous thing is to do at a given moment? Unlike Kantian or even utilitarian ethics of various kinds, you don't just have the sort of list of rules that can do all your moral deciding for you. You need the virtue of prudence to actually determine the mean or appropriate virtuous thing to do in a given situation. You know, what would be the brave thing to do right now? On the one hand, you might have a deficiency of fearlessness, and that would be cowardice. So the coward might assume that the brave thing to do would be to run away because he needs to save his life. But at the other extreme, you might have too much or irrational fearlessness, and that would be something like rashness or precipitation. Think of something like, you know, a Viking berserker or somebody who just charges a bunch of tanks with riflemen alone. You know, that wouldn't actually be an act of fortitude. It would be at the opposite extreme, which is too much fearlessness, but that's also a vice, the vice of rashness. So how do you determine the brave or courageous thing? You need prudence, sort of like someone finding a path in a dark forest at night, actually saying, this is the right way. So you cannot have moral virtue without prudence, because you need prudence to actually determine the virtuous thing to do characteristically throughout life. So that's point number one. Point number two, this is also in 58:4, he says, in order that man be disposed with regard to principles of action, that is the ends, he needs to be perfected by certain habits, whereby it becomes connatural, as it were, to man to judge aright to the end. This is done by moral virtue. For virtuous man judges correctly, about the end of virtue, because such as a man is, so does the end seem to him. Consequently, the right reason about things to be done, that is prudence, requires man to have moral virtue. The moral virtues, that is, being fortitude, temperance, and justice at the natural level, and then you also have hope and charity at the supernatural level. Okay, so what that means is you can't have prudence without fortitude, temperance, and justice, because in effect, your appetites will be seeking the wrong ends. And so when you deliberate about the means to those ends, the ends themselves will already be wrong. You know, the end of a miser, the end of a lecher are themselves vicious ends. And so when his principal reasoning deliberates, he's deliberating about means to get bad ends, and therefore he's pursuing vices. So in order to have prudence, you actually need the moral virtues giving you the correct or appropriate ends, so that when your moral reasoning kicks in, you're choosing the means to truly good ends. So you can't have prudence without the moral virtues, and you can't have the moral virtues without prudence, which leads to what's often called in the literature the unity thesis, that the four cardinal virtues are a package deal. You can't just pick some without others, but they're sort of like the four walls of the room that uphold the roof. You can't remove any and keep the rest. So it is a very integrated view of the moral life. And some people find this counterintuitive, because they'll say things like, well, I know some people who are really generous but lustful, or really courageous but financially corrupt, or something like that. But this is something we'll have to look at later, because we're running out of time. They wouldn't actually be virtuous, according to Aquinas' account. To get to something Robert brought up earlier, they would have certain good inclinations, but those would actually fall short of a virtue. Okay, one intuitive claim, though, that I've heard from Rosalind Hirsess is, she calls it the weak unity thesis, just a way of explaining to people how it's actually not that counterintuitive to say that the virtues are either, you know, you have them all or you have none. She says, consider the phenomenon of scandal. You know, she might give an example like a famous televangelist who, you know, millions of people watch on TV, they hear the sermons, you know, they believe they have powers of healing. And then they find out this person has been going to prostitutes, he's married, you know, so there's all sorts of compromise. But she, in effect, asks the question, why do you expect somebody who has the virtue of faith to also have the virtue of fidelity and the virtue of chastity? It is a good thing that you assume that, but notice that we don't often assume that of just skills. So you don't assume that because somebody is good at soccer, that they're therefore good at math, or because they're good at the violin, therefore they're good at shipbuilding. But the assumption that you should have not only one virtue, like faith, but you should also have fidelity and to your spouse and chastity and so forth, that actually is something we intuitively do assume people have responsibility for, which is, so she says, in a sort of indirect way, through the phenomenon of scandal, you know, when we find out that somebody who was morally good in one area is actually very morally bad in another, the very fact that this scandalizes us presupposes that we have already, in effect, bought into the unity thesis, because we presume that people should have overall moral integrity. That you don't just get a free pass if you say, well, just like I'm good at math, but really bad at soccer, you know, I'm good at faith, but bad at fidelity than my spouse. We recognize that that is a sort of rationalization or cop-out. So that's a sort of more intuitive approach to that thesis.
Yeah, I don't buy it. Isn't the problem with the televangelist that he's preaching chastity and he's preaching fidelity, and then it turns out he's not living up to them? If I trust my banker because he's super, super honest, and it turns out he cheats on his wife, I usually don't care. I don't care about the televangelist.
Yeah.
I'd love to think Hirschhaus is right about that, but I'm not sure I am.
That's right, yeah. The more, Aquinas would say, the more someone has moral dignity or is identified as an exemplar, the more it increases scandal, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Ordain and Establish. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you'd like to learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.